Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, hello, hello. I'm your barely clad hostess with the mostest, Michael Munoz. And welcome to In Yo Mouth.
In Yo Mouth.
I'm the queen of food who's always in the mood.
To lick it right, lick it good, show you how to
look. Oh, God, that's good.
I want to know what you eat from the streets to the sheets.
So open wide, honey.
I'm coming.
In Yo
goosebumps.
Hey there and welcome back, folks. Once again, I'm your hostess with the mostest, Munoz. And how you all doing? Oh my God, summer feels like it's here in New York City and I am ready. You know what? I saw this thing on the internet. I am vaxxed, I am waxed, and ready to be sexed. There's a ghost in the studio, folks, and I can't, and I'm just going to cut to the chase because I have been after this man for so long, and you know what I say all the time on this podcast, it's right time, right place, and things happen for a reason, and today I am so excited to have him here. I mean, I am jumping out of my skin, so please help me welcome the one, the only, the bare naked chef himself, Adrien de Baradeniz. Say wow. Hi.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Michael. Thank you so much. What an introduction. Wow, that was, I did not expect that. And I'm flattered that you have been sort of trying to seek me out for so long. Had I known, I would have flown up to New York on a Concorde and come to your studio.
Not the Concorde. You know, we are men of a certain age, especially old gay men of a certain age, if we're referencing the Concorde.
I'm trying to make a Concorde come back, okay? So we're not talking grapes.
Yes. Listen, I don't have a man that I know of that would take a Concorde to see me. So I accept. In Your Mouth, listeners, I am sure you know who Adrien is, or AKA the Bare Naked Chef. But if you do not, please get to the Instagram at the Bare Naked Chef and see all the boobs, all the skin, and all the cooking at the same time. But if you don't know, Adrien has been cooking since the ripe age of 8. But you may know him, obviously, from his very successful internet presence, or perhaps you may know him from season 11 of The Real Housewives of New York City, cooking at Bluestone Manor, and my favorite, Bethany and one Dorinda Medley.
Or what a trip.
Yeah, right? We're going to get into it for sure. Or then as a guest bartender on Watch What Happens Live. Or maybe you know him as one of the chefs that went on tour with Michelle Obama during her book tour for Becoming. He also has cooked for the likes of Angela Bassett, Demi Lovato, Sofia Vergara, and Joe Manganiello. Oh, God, just to drop a few names here, folks. Mm-hmm. What you may not know is that he launched his career right here in New York City at 2 of like New York's, you know, most famous like go-to restaurants. One is Cafeteria and the other is Frank. But Adrien, before we get anywhere, in the grand tradition of In Your Mouth, I need to wish you happy National Blueberry Pie Day.
You know, I'm drinking a blueberry smoothie right now in honor. it's not a pie because I got to keep this body tight, but
For the internet, at least.
For the internet. Yeah. But cheers to that.
Cheers to blueberry pie. Are you a big baker as well?
You know, I started out when I was a kid really interested in baking. And my mom bought me this, like, kids baking cookbook at a garage sale once. So that's really, I think, how I got into cooking. But I grew up in restaurants. My family had restaurants and pizzerias, Italian restaurants. Surprise, surprise.
So, I mean, blueberry pie, pizza pie. What's the difference?
Really? Yeah. It's just, you know, swap the tomato sauce for some blueberry jam, right?
I know.
Blueberry is actually one of my favorite pies, to be honest with you.
Now, here's a question for you. Like, because some people really love the, like, processed gelatinousness. Of it all, like uh-huh. like an Entenmann's or a
Mrs.
or a
Smith's.
Hostess or Mrs. Smith's, right?
Yeah.
Or those Hostess. Remember, like growing up, the hand pies.
Yeah.
Or are you like fresh, farm to table kind of gal here?
I'm not mad at processed pie fillings, to be honest with you, because it does make your job a lot easier. I mean, it's hard to find things fresh cherries to make into a cherry pie. So like they put cherries in a can for that purpose. Blueberries is a little bit easier because you can use fresh blueberries or even frozen blueberries. Can't really find frozen cherries. It's hard to find.
Yeah.
But, I always mix, some jam in with my pie filling. So you're always going to get a little bit of gelatinousness in there.
Yeah, for sure. And I love that little tip, y'all. Get into the tip of it all or just the tip. And I love that you also brought us to a place of finding our cherries because I haven't seen my...
I'm looking real, real hard.
Oh my God. Well, you know what? No matter what you celebrate on this beautiful New York City, or you're in Fort Lauderdale, right?
I am actually, I'm in Palm Beach. Yeah.
You're in Palm Beach.
West Palm Beach. Yeah. West Palm Beach. But yeah.
Oh, or it's, West it's, Palm Beach. That's a Luann thing too. That's a very New York
speaking
house.
Speaking of which, I had a little chat with Tinsley Mortimer yesterday on Instagram. I'll tell you about it later.
Oh, my God. Amazing. Well, no matter what you're celebrating today, whether it's the nice weather, blueberry pie, or just the beautiful man that is Adrian, happy National Blueberry Pie Day to you. And, Adrian, did you know that in 1981, on this day in gay history, former Beverly Hills hairdresser Marilyn Barnett files a multi-million-dollar palimony suit against tennis pro Billie Jean King, claiming that the two had a lesbian relationship for 7 years and
really?
That she is therefore entitled to the tennis star's Malibu beach house, as well as half of King's earnings from the period when they were together.
That's really interesting. I had no idea. I don't know a lot about Billie Jean King, but that definitely piques my interest. And how does a hairdresser have entitlement to a property? That's what I want to know. I guess because they're in a relationship.
They're in a 7-year relationship, but
they
weren't
married.
They weren't, but there's common law marriage.
Common law, right? Right.
Of it all. And I mean, I don't know the California. I should have looked that up. California common law marriage things, because I know common law marriage here in New York is really iffy and not
iffy
a thing.
Where I grew up. I remember because I learned about common law marriage because some neighbors of mine were an unwed couple. And I remember my mother explaining to me that they're in common law marriage and I was like, what's common law marriage? And so she explained the whole deal with me. But in Canada, it's, I think, universally, it's like a really kind of easy trap to fall into.
Wow. Wow. Look at that. Well, I mean, I also fell down. I don't know much about Billie Jean King either. And I fell down a little bit of a hole here just because, the sports of it all. And at the time, she was like, she was claiming she wasn't a lesbian. She was married to Larry King, not the Larry King. He was a different Larry King. And this whole thing. And then later on, she left Larry King for another woman. So there's a movie out there about it, too.
There's a docu-pic with the redhead from The Help. What's her name? I'm so bad with names sometimes.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
I'm not good at this game.
Anyhow, she
the worst at this movie trivia game.
That was like the first really kind of exposure I had to Billie Jean King, and it was really actually well done movie. But I don't remember. I know she was in a couple long term relationships, but I don't remember
the hairdresser.
But I'm sort of drawing a blank because it wasn't on my radar.
It was an interesting day in gay history, right? In 1981, the year of my birth.
Happy birthday!
I just turned 40. Look at that! Skin. Yeah.
Not a day over 32, I would have to say. Yeah. There's no special lighting in that studio either, is it?
No, nothing at all. I can show you. It's a mess, but I'll take it. Keep talking to me like this. I'm coming out to Palm Beach in a minute.
Well, you've got that gorgeous Latin skin that doesn't crinkle, wrinkle, or fade.
So. Yes, listen, beige don't age. And once again, now my seat is moist. So we're just going to get to the getting on and start where I always love to start, at the beginning. So you started cooking at a very young age. Where did this love of cooking come from?
Well, like I said, my family had restaurants growing up. My parents were foodies. My grandmother was an incredible cook, home cook. And really, I think instilled in my dad's generation of how the importance of good food, cooking with seasonal fresh ingredients, cooking sustainably, that kind of thing, all kind of tied into our lifestyle growing up. And then with the ownership of restaurants, of course, every single one of us had to work in them starting at a young age. So we developed a love and passion and respect for food at a really young age, me and my brothers and all my cousins.
So you were just rolling out pizza dough at age 8. Like, what was your job?
Pretty much. I mean, really? we were all eager to make some coins. So my dad was like, well, go work in the pizzeria. So I think my first job was working the soda fountain and the cash register. So it was taking people's money and standing on a milk crate and working that station. But eventually you kind of worked your way into the kitchen and were flipping pizzas and then all the other dishes that we served there. So we really got to kind of get a full scope of how it works in a fast casual dining kitchen at a young age. Yeah. So
Do you think that happens? This just sparked a thought in my head hearing you talk about this, because I remember I started working at age 15. I had to get working papers from my high school because I wasn't I wasn't 16 yet. And so at age 15, I had to, go into the dean's office or whatnot and apply through the state or whatnot and get working papers. And my first job was a runner at a brokerage firm. So I would run from the brokerage firm on Madison Avenue and 55th to the floor of the stock exchange.
Really?
Back and forth. And that was before the computers and whatnot. So there was papers and before 9/11. Yeah.
The
vacuum tubes before 9/11, right? Where I would go through a metal detector, but they knew me after a while and I would just walk in and out and things like that. And I was just thinking about the work ethic of children these days and how the world has changed and if that even still happens. Yeah.
It's a shame. No, it's a shame. I mean, we were all, everybody had paper routes. People don't get papers anymore delivered to their door. It's all digital. So, I think even I took a paper route even before working in food. And that was sort of a norm in my neighborhood.
Yeah, not even I guess we had an allowance. We did chores around the house, not for an allowance, just because it's what you did. You scoured the pots and you cleaned the bathroom and that's what it is. And so that hustle, even to this day, I think it's still, and it's, you can see it in you with how much you work and how many pots you have your hands in, pun intended, and myself too. The hustle of continuing, what's next? Okay, what else can I be doing to keep this going? I don't know if you remember, but we had met at the New York Wine and Food Festival.
Yes. That's funny. I was just actually talking to somebody about that that year, that experience, and actually how much fun. My cousin, I brought two of my girl cousins. I don't know if you remember. There were two really pretty girls working behind me.
Okay.
And she actually lives here in Palm Beach. She flew down just so she could be my assistant because she's such a housewives addict. She wanted to meet Luann. So she's like, I'll do anything. She's like, I'll even like, you know, wash dishes. Just let me tag along. But no, she was great. And so, yeah, we were just kind of reminiscing about that. That's funny you brought that up.
Yeah, because it was you, Zach Young was there, who I know. I think that was New York Wine and Food Festival's first drag brunch.
Yeah. That was 2 years ago.
Two? No.
Yeah. Well, three, maybe.
20,
three.
19, three. 18. Yeah, three years ago.
3 years. Well, okay.
We lost the year.
I feel like 2020 just didn't happen. Like, honestly, it's like completely erased from my memory because there was nothing that monumental that happened that year except for a pandemic. But that's,
I mean, we call it the dark times or the before time.
Before COVID, BC. There you go.
That's it. Yeah. So you grow up cooking in restaurants and whatnot, and then you decide to move to New York. Had you gone to culinary school beforehand, or did you just end up in the kitchen at cafeteria, right, serving the girls from Sex and the City?
I actually started as a server at the cafeteria. This was post 9/11. I was like, because I had my plan was to go take some courses at Pace University, and I had enrolled, and first day of class was 9/11, 8:30 in the morning. I was supposed to be down by the World Trade Center that morning, and I actually slept in. I'm not proud of, well, I am actually proud of it because I escaped that nightmare, but I would have been stuck down there that morning. And anyhow, so I was traumatized. I didn't want to kind of go down there and go to class every single day. It completely changed my whole plan, outlook. It just kind of really just turned everything upside down. So I was like, well, I'm going to get a job. And I had, you know, restaurant experience. So I went and applied to cafeteria. And of course, the only shifts that were available were the graveyard shifts. So I was working midnight till 8 a.m. for the first like 2 months I started working there. And then, I got friendly with the managers and the staff, and I got to know them. And then eventually, you know, they kind of learned that my passion was in the kitchen. So they started putting me in the line there. Well, I was kind of really started washing dishes and then worked my way up a little bit. I wasn't there that long, but I ended up going to the East Village to another restaurant there. That was actually...
Frank? Was that,
yeah.
Yeah. So Frank is like this little hole in the wall in the East Village, but they have some outlets. I don't know if they all survived the pandemic or not. I know one did, like I think it's the original one where it's
the original one is on second between
fifth and sixth.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
Something like that. But the, you know, Frank was very successful with that restaurant. I mean, he went off and opened up like four or five, you know, he opened Supper. He opened the other one that's on First and First.
Yeah.
And a couple in Brooklyn. I mean, and then, you know, they had some other employees leave and open up Max, which is basically a carbon copy of Frank. But
yeah, in your mouth, listeners, 1 second. I just wanted to explain to the audience who's not here in New York, because we're going on and on as if everyone knows what Frank's is. And it's one of these like really low key, like New York staple Italian joints, like almost like a red sauce joint. They serve really authentic fare. It's home cooking. There's nothing like overly pretentious about it or you know, these like overly dressed plates. It's like, if you're ordering meatballs, you're getting meatballs.
And I mean, the tables are covered literally in like plastic. I mean, it was basically the antithesis of what was happening during the time when it opened. It became this like really chic kind of undiscovered hotspot in the East Village. You know, East Village was super cool back then. Still, it was like one of the last, you know, neighborhoods in New York to not be Disneyfied. Yeah. And, you know, so Frank was this young, I want to say he's probably in his late 20s, early 30s, this sort of ambitious you know, young chef who wanted to just open this like old school grand, like his inspiration was like his nonna, his grandma. And so he opened up Frank, and it was like there were they were turning people away constantly away from that place. I mean, it's small, yeah. But it became a real kind of hotspot. And so to work there was like it was a huge thrill for me, because I'm like, here I am. I just, you know, kind of plopped in New York, and it's post 9/11. I didn't really know what the hell I was doing, and it gave me a little bit of I don't know. It gives you a little bit of identity, maybe a little bit of. Sort of purpose, and you kind of feel like you're doing something kind of cool and New Yorkish, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the food is delicious to this day.
The food is great. Yeah,
it's so good. I mean, the meatballs are the size of a meatloaf.
No. Yeah, I'm actually. I mean, it's been. I want to say it's been a couple of years since I've eaten there, but I mean, even after I left, I still continued to go there and eat, and the quality of the food just never was. Changed or compromised, which is really remarkable for a restaurant that's been open that long. You know, we're talking 20 years.
Yeah.
21 years it's been open.
That actually is remarkable, because, you know, as kitchen life, as hands change and chefs change and,
oh, yeah.
You know, quality of food. So that's a testament to the owner and like right. The standards of the restaurant as far as, you know, just like quality control. Because I always say, this about New York City restaurants, you either have to be really, really good or really bad, like food wise, to make it. You know,
it's so that, like, true. There's no middle ground.
You can't be like, yeah, you can have really terrible food, and for some reason, you will have a restaurant forever. For some reason, but like, there's no in between. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say. I mean, you know, the survival rate of a restaurant in general is low. I mean, the percentage of you. Sustaining, you know, business over a year. I'm not even talking COVID,
yeah,
pre-COVID, and to be in New York, you know, you can imagine the concentration and the competition. It's even smaller than that. So, for a restaurant to succeed in New York, you really have to either have a gimmick, you know, and great PR, or the food has to be absolutely fantastic, you know, or lousy food. And you know, so Frank was, you know, he was there every single day. I mean, he was definitely a restaurant owner chef who was, you know, married to his business. And so the fact that the food really hasn't changed all that much since he's not really there, you know, he's probably got a handful of other projects going. Yeah.
Or like a mansion in Palm Beach and he's chilling.
Right. I don't see Frank as a Palm Beach guy. Maybe Miami, South Beach for sure. But
yeah. There's something like that. But I want to talk about, for a quick second, growing up in the kitchen, but growing up gay in the kitchen. What has that experience been like for you? Because obviously, we're on a big gay food podcast here, and kitchens mm-hmm. are a hyper-masculine space that, you know, are ever-changing, especially during these times. What was that experience like for you?
They are. You know, it's sort of interesting. I've never actually been asked a question that way, so it's interesting you have me thinking. I mean, really, when you're in the kitchen, you're sort of on pilot, you know, autopilot. You're working really fast, and you're just, you know, kind of trying to get things done. There isn't even much room for conversation or, you know, social interaction between your peers, you know, and your coworkers. I think food is actually the great sort of leveler. I mean, I think your palate is really what defines you. People don't really necessarily care about sexual orientation, even though it is a hetero-dominated field. I have to say, you know, a great impetus of me doing Bare Naked Chef was to give visibility to gay chefs, which I felt like there was a huge lack of and a void in the industry. A lot of the chefs that were represented on television, you know, with the exception of one or two that I can think of, were predominantly really stereotypical macho men, you know, guys like Guy Fieri and Mario Batali, and, you know, Emeril Lagasse. I mean, who can identify with that if you're not some like truck driver from St. Louis? You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
And I understand that was sort of the mass appeal for them, but there really was no sort of representation of diversity there until they started getting more women. And then, but even still, there isn't an openly gay chef that has a series on Chef on Food Network right now.
Yeah. I mean, why do you think this podcast exists? To give a voice to people like you, like me, right? In the community, right? Who are cooking, who are doing amazing things in food, you know? What was coming out like for you?
Very liberating, very liberating. I had a really tough closeted childhood. My parents at an early age, God bless them, you know, they didn't know any better, but they put me in reparative therapy at the age of 5. So I was going through sort of the psychological process of, you know, turning me back for, I want to say, about 11 years. I had to regularly visit this psychiatric hospital and see this doctor who actually, I later found out in life, in my 20s, around when I came out, is a pariah in the gay community, because he fought to keep homosexuality and transgender identity disorder in the DSM, if you can believe that. For those of you that don't know, the DSM is like the psychological encyclopedia. So it lists every single mental illness, disorder, what have you. And up until 1976, homosexuality was considered an illness, a mental illness. And they finally removed it. And this, forgive my French, but this asshole, this doctor who was treating me, or tried to, he went to court to battle it and fight to keep it back in. So if you can imagine, you know, me growing up in a very kind of liberal, cosmopolitan city such as Toronto, you know, being exposed to many things. My father was also a hairdresser. So he, you know, I had, you know, gay people kind of in the periphery. And then being confronted with this, you know, blaring sort of persecution of who I was. So I had to keep it hidden for many, many years. And then, you know, luckily I sort of moved far away from my family. I came into myself and then came out when I was about 23 years old in Dallas, Texas. God bless Dallas. You know, I had my first everything there, first gay friends, you know, relationships, circuit parties, things like that, things that, you know, you get to experience as a gay man. And then it really sort of started to unfold from there. And that's when I started, that's when I moved from Dallas back to New York. That's when I, you know, started getting back into food and sort of working in the restaurant circuit.
So, A, thank you for sharing that. And B, the beauty of this, of what I do, is giving people like you a platform to tell their stories. And I always say our stories matter. And through this podcast, right now we're over 3 years in the game here. I'm using the royal we and me, is that I've heard stories of like foster. We've heard good and bad stories is what I'm trying to say here, right? From foster care to the most fabulous, like, mom let me play dress up from a very young age. This is an in your mouth first of reparative therapy. And it's very serious. It's something that still happens out there
in
the world. There are some states, I don't have that information on me, that's not illegal to do, you know?
Yeah.
And what was the key to overcoming and coming through then?
Forgiveness. Really, forgiveness.
Forgiveness, you know, of yourself or others?
Others and myself, really. I mean, I remember having a huge confrontation when I moved back from Dallas to where my parents were, because I didn't have an apartment in New York, so I had to stay with them until I could, afford to move out. But and that was, you know, post me coming out. And I remember having this really, it was almost like a volcano eruption of emotion for me, and being very upfront, because they never told me why I was going. The conversation of like, you are different, you need to get help, was never even on the table. It was all very hush hush. So, you know, I was almost told like I was going because I had temper issues. That was where sort of like, but I knew exactly why I was going, clearly. But, so it was my family's, you know, very much, they didn't talk about their feelings. So this was sort of this backlog of stuff that had built up over the years. And I felt the need to express to them what that experience in how it impacted me. And they just sat there and listened, and they were very apologetic. And they just said, we did what we thought was right. and we didn't want you to suffer. And, you know, after hearing that and doing years of therapy after that, on my own accord, I kind of realized, you know, they didn't know any better. They weren't doing it to harm me, but, you know, it's their own internalized homophobia that drove them to that point. And, you know, that's not my cross to bear. I think as my experience, I hope that I maybe changed them in some way in looking at the world differently. But I do have to say out there, just to kind of backtrack, you know, the reparative therapy and the conversion therapy thing is a serious, serious problem in this country and in the world still. And, you know, a lot of parents and organizations get away with it because they do it in a religious setting. And there, when it's done in a religious setting, it doesn't have to be documented. There's nothing that has to be submitted in terms of, you know, a psychological evaluation or anything like that. It's just priests praying the gay away. And so, you know, it has irreparable effects on young people to the point of where it drives a large percentage of us to take our own lives. And that is something that I realized coming out of this that, fortunately, I was not that statistic.
For sure. And just as a side note, if this is you out there, there is help out there. There are people you can talk to.
Absolutely.
There are people you can reach out to. There's the suicide hotline. There is also the trans hotline now.
Yes.
Well. We've moved forward so much in this world, although there's still battles to be won, but there is help out there. And I want to make that
absolutely
very clear.
You know? Absolutely. And don't give up. Don't give up and don't let anybody, you know, sort of kill your spirit, because you are who you are for a reason. And that's, you know, that is parents don't know what's best for you all the time.
Exactly. And you are a testament of beauty and success and coming through of it all, honey. Let me tell you. Plus, I mean, if they sent you for temper, there is nothing like a gay man scorned, honey.
There you
talk
go.
Talk about that gay temper.
I should have shown them like a PowerPoint of like how much money they spent and how their money on both counts didn't get their value met. So
exactly, you know? Exactly. Before I take you out to one of our favorite part of the pod, or my favorite part of the pod, I should say, one quick question. Is everything bigger in Texas?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I moved there and I was like, wow.
For that reason?
I mean, just, you know, the people are bigger in general. They're, you know, all corn-fed farm folk. It's like, you know, I grew up in Toronto. Everybody's like a, you know, a half-breed of Portuguese and something else. And it's like, you know, there's such a diverse multicultural ethnicity blend in Canada that everybody kind of looks so exotic, but you're living in it and you're not noticing that there's nobody that looks like the people that you see on television. And then you go down to Texas and it's like everyone's, you know, there's like big blonde, you know, blue-eyed farm boys.
For
it's
sure.
It's kind of fun.
I bet. Mm-hmm. I have done a tour of Texas myself. And with that, I think now is a great time to take Adrian to my favorite part of the pod and your favorite part of the pod. Give us a little break here to a little something we like to call Food News Update.
News
up. Food news.
Ooh, honey, you ain't ready,
girl. Spill the tea.
News update.
Kellogg's is releasing a glittery pride-themed cereal in conjunction with Glad.
Really? Okay. Yes.
Isn't this everything? I mean,
interesting. Everyone's getting in on the pride game, huh?
Yeah. Finally. Yes, I mean, and there, we talk about pride baiting from bigger corporations here all the time, and that's when like corporations just throw a rainbow on it and be like, just for the season, it's like pride, right? And they're not really doing anything for the community. But
correct.
This is not Kellogg's first time at the rodeo, I found out. So according to Out.com, thank you, Out.com, Kellogg's and Glad have teamed up again to create a rainbow-themed breakfast cereal in honor of Pride Month. They've launched a special Together with Pride cereal filled with rainbow and heart-shaped bites and sprinkled with edible glitter to turn your dull breakfast into something more proud and fabulous. Best of all, Kellogg's announced that they will donate portions of their sales from Together with Pride cereal to GLAAD to help aid in their anti-bullying and LGBTQ plus advocacy efforts.
Thank you. That's what I was waiting for. I mean, finally, like you said, you know, it was not just, you know, some sort of pandering to get more business from people. They're actually putting money back in to the cause, which is refreshing to hear.
Yeah,
sure.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's great. And I mean, who doesn't love some glitter in their cereal?
I mean, just as long as it's like, you know, been tested by the FDA. And like,
edible glitter.
Yeah.
And no, then, I mean, it just makes everything more fabulous. Are you one of these like glitter hating people? Are you?
You know why I hate glitter? Because it reminds me of my early 20s coming home from the club and being covered in it. Because everybody back then covered themselves, you know, at the Roxy, like covered themselves in glitter. And you're finding that shit like in your, you know, your like underwear after you've washed it for 3 times. You know, I don't know. It brings back memories of a night that never ended.
Goodness. I am a glitter fiend. And at last year during the height of the pandemic when the Black Lives Matter protests were happening, and then we did the Queer March because Pride was canceled for obvious reasons. Mm. I am a glitter fiend. I love it. And the people around me know I love it. And they saw me with it and they were like, Michael. And I said, listen, somebody take this away from me. Just take it away. Yeah. It's on me. And if you take it away, I can't like get crazy and throw it on people. You know, halfway through the day, it ended up back on my hand, in my hand somehow. Because no one threw it out.
Right.
And then it ended up everywhere. And I was like, I won't be blamed. I just won't be blamed.
I wish somebody would invent like a biodegradable glitter. That's all. That's all. Well, does that exist?
No, it doesn't exist. And I think actually if you research, I think I read this once upon a time, that glitter is actually a problem for like the environment or something. And this with Earth Day that just had passed us, you know?
Yeah, okay. That makes sense. So, I mean, I'm like, there's got to be some sort of, you know, even contact with someone's skin, even though they have like edible versions of it.
Yeah.
Or sort of, you know, stuff that you can, that's skin safe. It's got to clog pores or something. I don't know.
I love it. I will always love it. I think I will be like 86 and still just being like glitter, glitter, glitter. And what?
You're going to be that guy.
Oh, yeah. I am that guy already. So I don't think that's going anywhere. Oh, my God. I think we're here for this. So a big shout out to Kellogg's for pairing with GLAAD.
I agree. For sure. I'm in huge support of that. So
Taco Bell will recycle those hot sauce packets for you. Apparently, Taco Bell hot sauce is such a phenomena that they're starting a recycling program for them.
Meaning what? The empty packets or like the unused packets?
No, the empty packets. Like,
okay.
Do you own an espresso machine? Nespresso, not espresso.
You know, I used to. I don't anymore because of the waste and then the cost. Those pods were ridiculously expensive. But the waste of those pods,
So Nespresso will give you a pre-labeled UPS bag to throw those pods in because they compost the coffee and recycle the aluminum into new things, right? Like that's a big
smart
thing for that Nespresso brand.
Yeah.
And
okay.
So this, I think, emulates, Taco Bell is trying to emulate that program because their hot sauces have such a cult-like following that there's something like 8.2 billion Taco Bell sauce packets are used in the U.S. each year. That figure exceeds the number of people on Earth, much less the number of Taco Bell customers in a country of 329 million people. Even if you presume that half of the United States population is responsible for that level of sauce packet consumption, that's about 50 packets per person annually.
Okay, you know, I don't know, but I mean, I don't know how accurate that statistic is, only because I know that I opened my kitchen cupboard and I have a gigantic Ziploc freezer bag full of like ketchup packets and hot sauce packets and stuff from fast food restaurants that I don't want to throw away. And I think that I'm going to use one day. Yeah, that's crazy. That's crazy. That's a lot of sauce. That's a lot of sauce. Why don't they put bottles in their restaurants? Doesn't that make sense?
Yeah, but people like to, like, but it's drunk food. You know, it's drunk high food. It's late night food. It's like delicious, not good for you food, right?
I mean, it's amazing.
It's so good. It is so, so good. And this is from thetakeout.com. So this was a press release that Taco Bell itself sent out. But this is something they're trying to test and put into action. And you know what? Anything that's going to reduce carbon footprint and actually take... you know, something and make it into something new. They're using a company, they're trying to use a company called TerraCycle, which is renowned for collecting traditionally non-recyclable materials, cleaning them, and then melting them and remolding them into hard plastic that can be used to make new recycled products.
So that would mean that the restaurants have to separate the packages, you know, that are
out,
being,
or they have
waste.
Or they have to do what Nespresso is doing and give you a packet to throw the packets in to then mail someplace to then
see. I like the intention. I feel like all fast food restaurants should have programs like this. Yeah. But the sorting issue, I mean, you know, the recycling,
it's gonna be hard.
The recycling is it's tough because a lot of this stuff ends up getting thrown in the trash after the recycling plants sort of try to sift through it and they just like, yeah, like, ah, whatever. And who knows how much of that stuff really is getting recycled. But I think that there needs to be an awareness on the corporate end of a lot of these restaurants that they need to start recycling a lot of the stuff. I mean,
yeah, well, let's hope this is the beginning and not just the stunt. I'm here for it. I'm here for it. If Taco Bell can pull it off, I am absolutely here for it. And I mean, there's nothing more I think to say about it than like have at it, Taco Bell, and let us know what we need to do to help
and what we need to do and how it works out. Yeah.
And how it works out, right, for you, because we are here to, you know, reduce our carbon footprint in any way possible.
For sure.
And last but not least, Amazon is bringing its palm scanning payment option to Whole Foods.
Oh, God.
Could you imagine?
I didn't even know Amazon had a hand scan, or it's like, what is it? A foot, like a fingerprint?
No, it's like a scan your palm
like
to
Star
pay.
Trek.
Star
Trek.
Like Star Trek.
Leave it to Amazon. That's crazy. So now you can go to Whole Foods and put your palm on. What about COVID? Are people concerned about
putting
your hand?
No, it would be, you don't have to put it on. It's just over.
Okay.
Like, you just do it over and somehow it scans your palm and then your palm is attached to payment options and your Amazon account. And then
and that's a signature that cannot be,
well,
cannot be frauded or, you know, copy, can't be.
Apparently not, according to Food and Wine. This technology uses biometric data to let customers pay with a swipe of their hand.
Wow.
Last September, Amazon launched a new contactless payment option that allowed customers to pay for items at two of its Amazon Go stores in Seattle.
Okay.
And it's trying to bring this test it out at a Whole Foods. Yeah.
Okay.
That's
cool.
I'm trying to find it in this article, but it says that palm scanning is like, it's hard. So why the palm scan? It's a pretty good body part as far as biometric options go. Palm recognition is considered more private than some biometric alternatives because you can't determine a person's identity by looking at an image of their palm. It also requires someone to make an intentional gesture by holding their palm over the device to use. And it's contactless, which we think customers will appreciate, especially in current times.
Hmm. Well, that seems like a great alternative to, you know, the
using your palm.
But you know, the phone thing, I this morning actually I went to the grocery store and I realized I left my debit card in a credit card machine in Fort Lauderdale yesterday at a 7-Eleven because that was the last place I went.
Or at the Eagle.
I didn't actually go to the Eagle, but that would have been a better story. Yeah. No, and so I know I was at the grocery store. I'm like, shit, I can't find my card. And fortunately, you know, I have Apple Pay. So, you know, it's sort of the next generation, I guess. I mean, you don't even need your phone. You don't even need, you know, electricity. You can just use your hand and go. That's cool.
It's so crazy. I saw this meme because everyone loves a meme out there about, and it was four squares of the Jetsons doing different things. It was like one of George Jetson on like working from home, one of Judy and Elroy getting like a televideo doctor's visit, one of like learning how to do something via video, and something else. And it was like, remember when we thought this was crazy? Right. Yeah, and now, right. And now it's all we do.
It's so true.
So, you know what? Who knows what the future holds, right? Because I mean, we didn't expect what was happening over the last year and a half at this point.
God, no. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, here's to bigger and better. And with that, I think that's a great way to end.
Totally.
Food news update.
Oh, great segment.
I hope that was a day brightener for you.
That was, actually. I'm like, can't wait to go text a bunch of people about this like Amazon thing. It's
yeah, right? Isn't that weird? Now, yeah. Talk to me. I mean, listen, as the Bare Naked Chef, would you prefer to swipe a different body part?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know. For sanitary reasons, probably wouldn't be the safest, but, you know, a palm works.
I mean, now that you brought it up, talk to me about the Bare Naked Chef of it all and why you felt the need to be naked, all right? And I'm not complaining. And by the by, why aren't you naked now?
That's a good question. I don't know. I like to throw people off. People always assume that I'm just going to be, you know, you can go on my Instagram and see my, you know, my
Listen,
skin
I had the naked nutritionist on a few weeks ago, too, or more than a month ago. He wasn't naked either. All these naked people out there not being naked, I don't understand.
It seems like a fraud, doesn't it? It seems like a whole ruse. You know, you asked me a question I get a lot, and it's forced me to really sort of think introspectively about it, because, you know, it's not just sort of one layer of, you know, the obvious. It's, you know, I did it at a time, you know, I started the project at a time when I was going through this kind of catharsis where I finally was, you know, I was in my late 30s. I was sort of, you realize you don't kind of feel like you're grown into yourself until you reach 40. And it was at a point in my life where I was, felt really good about where I was at mentally, emotionally, spiritually. And I had nothing to hide. And I realized, I mean, I'm going to just kind of bear it all. That was sort of the meta meaning behind doing Bare Naked. But it also represents the kind of food that I make, being, you know, kind of health conscious, in that it's all using whole foods. I don't use anything with preservatives. Naked foods, pretty much things that are in season, sustainable. And then, you know, obviously the naked thing was a gimmick. I'm not going to, you know, be coy about that. That was something to grab attention. Of course, what grabs attention better from people, especially the LGBTQI community, is than some skin, you know? Turn on your Instagram, open up your Instagram. That's kind of like all you get these days. You know, 6 years ago, it was sort of a little less in your face, I think, because of the kind of commonality of it. And there was also, you know, a lack of representation, like, as I mentioned, of LGBTQI chefs in that sphere. So what better way to sort of give yourself visibility? I really wanted to create, like, it was almost like a tongue-in-cheek project. It wasn't even, I didn't even do it to kind of, like, get famous or kind of, like, I just had this, like, kooky idea where I wanted to do like a Food Network looking show where I'm cooking naked, and I'm actually like getting people interested in cooking. Yeah. And you know, because a lot of my friends like did not care or have any inclination to cook anymore. It was all about takeout and, you know, eating out. And I mean, I grew up, we rarely went to restaurants. I mean, it was all about, you know, food that was home cooked. And we did have restaurants that we ate from, but my parents were really big on, you know, primarily feeding us food that was home cooked.
Yeah.
And it also taught us to appreciate and love the act of it. So I really wanted to kind of share that with people and get people excited about cooking again. And I think it did. I mean, I got an outpouring of responses from people when I launched it, that they were like, oh my God, I'm going to try this recipe. I don't know how to cook, but you make it look so much easier than I thought it would be. And that was really it too. It's sort of stripping it down, making it look like it's not so intimidating.
Yeah. It's so interesting that you mention getting people excited to cook again, because I relate to it greatly as well, because I started my culinary journey back in 2009 when I was longing for like shows like the Graham Kerr of it all, you know, like there was a little bit more showmanship as opposed to the Giada De Laurentiis, like very quiet, very beautiful, all of that.
Like,
and
it was like nap time TV.
Yeah. To get people excited again, right. To give it a different spin and to do that. And it's like, you know, when did cooking become unexciting? When did it become so laborious? When did it become like this,
and
like so, next level
and
thing?
Cliched and sort of like mm-hmm. beneath people. Unfortunately, you know, yeah, there's great restaurants out there, and thank God for Uber Eats and all that, you know, but there's nothing like preparing and sharing a meal you've made from scratch. And that's
because it goes beyond that, right? It goes beyond the meal.
It's not even about the food anymore. Yeah. It's about convening and having conversations with people, bringing people around the table. And that's why I love actually the one, you know, this horrible, horrible pandemic, the effect it's had on my industry, on the food industry, is there's sort of it's a double-edged sword. It's destroyed the restaurant business, but in turn, it's forced people to learn how to cook for themselves. And these services like Blue Apron and HelloFresh are booming. Their businesses are booming now because people are actually like, well, I'm home for, you know, 16 hours a day. I have nothing else to do. I'm going to cook for my friends and my family. And they do. And they decide that these services are this sort of the next, you know, kind of level up. Rather than, you know, sort of do it. Also, it saves them from having to go to a grocery store and if they're concerned with being, you know, contactless purchasing, that kind of thing. So it really kind of bridges that gap for a lot of people where they can just be like, okay, this is it. I'm going to cook a meal. I have all the stuff I need. I'm going to cook. And I'm just, I'm actually happy that it's actually come to that, because that sort of served kind of the intention that I was, that I started my show with. So.
Yeah. That you and I are like kind of trying to like mold, and a lot of people out there, Jake Cohen, Grossi Pelosi, all these people who I have befriended via the podcast, whom I've known before or through this, or who I met before the podcast. And now we're coming together is like gathering people. And I think it's a great thing that has come out of this pandemic is, you know, making a meal and sharing it, and, you know, or making a meal and being forced to make a meal, right? Because we're stuck inside, and then being forced to share it via Zoom or via FaceTime or via whatever, right? Just because we needed to be together somehow, because we weren't allowed to be together, right?
Absolutely.
And it's a beautiful thing that has come through this, to be like, oh my God, remember that? But now we're all vaccinated, and the four of us can actually meet. And I'm going to make that dish again because it was so good.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
You know what I think we should do come June is if you should do a Zoom reunion podcast with all of us that you just mentioned, and we can all prepare a dish together.
Yeah, let's talk about it. I am here for it. I feel like I can talk to you for hours. But before we close out, we have to get to the Michelle Obama and the Housewives of it all. Were you naked for Michelle?
No. I was actually Chef Adrian when I worked for Michelle Obama. Although they did know. I mean, her chief of staff did the due diligence on me, of course.
Well, of course they had to.
Yeah, and they knew exactly, you know, my gig. My alter ego, if you will, or my side gig, but they were totally cool with it. I mean, that's a testament to how like chill and laid back that administration was, and that first family is, because they did not give a rat's ass about me, shaking my tail feather out there. And
they were like, "Can he cook? Yes, great. Yeah. Let's bring him on."
It was all about the food, definitely.
Yeah,
and,
for sure.
And actually, her mother came up to Art, my coworker and good friend, at the last event, and it was in Nashville, and she was like, "I saw you on Real Housewives, and I love that guy who was that naked chef that you were working with." She watched the episode and like was like all about it. So,
oh my God, how crazy are those women?
I mean, gotta love them, right? Gotta love them.
I mean, I do. I have a Dorinda Medley. I cooked. I decorated. I made it nice sweatshirt.
You and millions of others. Can we just talk for a second about the new season? Is she not on the new season?
No, she peaced out. Last season was enough for her, right?
Wow.
She was going. You know, the Bluestone Manor went under a lot of like repairs,
yeah,
right? And
yeah,
she lost a lot of her her deceased husband's things that she had never dealt with. So I think it was too much. And then she started to drink to cope. Not to say that she has a drinking problem or anything, right? Because I don't know her life like that. I'm just saying, via the television, this is kind of how it unfolded. And I think she just needed to step away and a break. And I will definitely miss her because she was just, she was my kind of gal. You know,
she was sort of like the, you know, becoming the focal point of the show. I mean, there was sort of, you know, every one of the franchises has their like their queen bee, right?
Yeah.
I feel like Dorinda was kind of becoming that. This is a shame. I haven't really kept up. I haven't watched last season, so I don't really know what's going on. But to answer your question, Bluestone Manor is gorgeous. It's absolutely stunning. This was post damage reparation, but she ended up doing like a whole revamp of of the house after that. Dorinda was super sweet. You know, she's a wild child. I mean, just like she is on television. My favorite, because I know you're going to ask me that, was Luann. I love Luann. The sober Luann.
All right. Good. And you know what? We support you, Luann, in that way as well. And what are these, what is Tinsley Mortimer sliding into your DMs about?
So I actually am starting to work at a restaurant here in Palm Beach, in the kitchen here. And it's an establishment that was previously owned by an owner. And it's been a staple for Palm Beach. And they, my cousin and her husband took it over, bought it and revamped the whole thing, brought new chefs in, you know, whole new staff. So they've been open for a couple months. And she knew she was a patron of the old establishment. So my cousin asked me if I could reach out to her, knowing that I was on the show, and I met her to see if she, you know, to invite her to come back in, just to let her know that the new place was open and that she was invited as a guest and they'd give her VIP treatment, blah, blah, blah. 6 months later, like 5 months later, because that was 5 months ago when it opened in November, and she just replied. I don't know if she was, because she was taping or whatnot, but she just said, "I'm just seeing this. forgive me, but I haven't been in Palm Beach. I've been back. I did come to the bar and have somebody eat, and I absolutely loved it and love what you guys done, but love what they've done with the place." So yeah, that was the exchange. But she's back in Palm Beach, and hopefully I'll see her at the restaurant if she comes in again.
I love that.
It's called Cafe Ligarope is what it's called. So any of you in the Palm Beach area, come see me.
Yeah, or if you're taking a vaccinated moment, you know, out, like once we can start traveling, or if you are traveling, right, safely out there, you know?
Of course.
Yes, definitely go visit Adrian. Oh my God, this has been amazing. And next time you're in the city, or next time I'm down in Florida, we have to come together.
Let's do it. We'll go eat some seafood down here. I hope you should come down here, because I'm sure you're dying to get out of New York.
Yes, absolutely. Right? Absolutely.
I do miss New York a little bit. I got to come up there.
I'm dying for a beach, though. I'm dying for a beach. And, you know, now I have COVID tummy, right? Coronavirus. Right?
I know, right?
So, like, who knows if that Speedo fits or not, but I don't care. I will let all my juicy bits hang out.
I'm sure you're going to get hit on left, right, and center in any case. So you need to get your butt down here, and we'll definitely Palm Beach it out.
Sure. Let the people know where they can find you, right? Because they're going to want to find you. Give them all the social media handles and everything.
So I'm just on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. Facebook, I'm Adrian Barardini's, the Bare Naked Chef. You can find me that way. Instagram is at the Bare Naked Chef, all one word. Twitter, I believe I am the only BearNkdChef.
Just Google. Google is your friend. Google is your friend. And I will link out the Instagram and all the things as well, in the show notes. Big thanks to you again.
Thank you. This was amazing.
This was so much fun. And I love that we finally connected and had a moment together. I am so appreciative of you and your time that you've spent with me and just getting to know you. It's been really, really, really special. Folks out there, you know what? Get out there. I'm just going to keep saying it. Get out there. Get vaccinated. Get some sunshine now that the weather's nicer. You know, help your neighbors get vaccinated. You know, I've been doing the thing as well.
Eat healthy, too. Eat healthy. Diet is such a huge, huge component with staying healthy, you guys.
Mentally
get
as well.
Get some sunlight, get some sunshine, go to the farmer's market, get some locally grown whatnot.
Yeah, that's been a big message of the pod these days too. Hit up your local farmer's markets now and get the good things and get them in you. And with that, I'm just going to say thank you for listening to In Yo Mouth.